The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think not only in the United States, but in open societies in general, we have seen a plague of political warfare emerging from cyberspace. Look, the problem is that in an information age, everything that makes you prosperous and powerful also makes you vulnerable. And for the United States in particular, a point I make in the book, while we have paid a great deal of attention to offensive capabilities, our defenses are the worst, certainly the worst in the developed countries. And I'm not the only one who says this. Richard Clark, who was cyber czar for a couple of presidents, wrote in his book on cyber war, and he actually has a little table there where he reflects on the offensive and defensive capabilities of the leading nations. And the United States comes in absolutely last on defense. And, you know, there was a time we talked about a strategic defense initiative in terms of Star Wars against nuclear weapons. And we sort of realize that's never possible, but we need a new strategic defense initiative, and it needs to be aimed at improving our security in cyberspace.
I'm Ian Enright, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for August 25th, 2021. Jack Goldsmith sat down with John Arquilla, analyst with the RAND Corporation. He's the author of a new book, Blitzkrieg: The New Challenge of Cyber Warfare. The two discussed the challenges posed by cyber warfare, which John argues have been neither met nor mastered. He offers solutions for protecting against enemies that are often anonymous, unpredictable, and capable of projecting force and influence vastly disproportionate to their size, strength, or wealth. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 25th, Blitzkrieg, with John Arquilla.
So, John, thanks for coming. I really liked your book, Blitzkrieg, The New Challenge of Cyber Warfare. You wrote a famous article 28 years ago called Cyber War is Coming. So I thought we should start off by you just telling us about that famous article and how you see the intervening 28 years and just an overview of what Blitzkrieg is about.
So I had the good fortune to be working with David Ronfelt at the RAND Corporation about 30 years ago, and he was working on information technologies and how they were going to change business and administration. I was a bombs and bullets guy who at RAND at the time, who was associated with a small team, included Zalmay Khalilzad, by the way, working for General Schwarzkopf during the Gulf crisis of 1990 and 1991, the subsequent Operation Desert Storm. And it occurred to me that something very unusual was happening that allowed us to win in a lopsided way. We had information systems that gave us an absolutely clear picture of what was going on, while our opponent could only see a part of the chessboard. Indeed, it was like a chess game in which we could see all the pieces and he could see only his own. And it led to a very rapid and tremendous victory at low cost. So I come back to RAND afterward, and David's office is across from mine, and I read his paper on what he called cyberocracy. And I said to him, David, I have one word for you, cyber war. And so we were off to the races and suggesting that the information revolution was going to have profound strategic implications for society and security. And in the intervening three decades, what I have found is that certainly in society and in business. We've seen a great transformation due to the information revolution. In the military, on the other hand, I think we've seen very, very little progress in understanding the importance of information systems, of keeping them secure, making the best use of them, disrupting the enemy systems in time of armed conflict. Very, very little change. And I think our record militarily over the last 20 years suggests a very, very small level of attention has been given to this. So 28 years later, I'm pretty disappointed on the military level. I am, however, very impressed with the ways in which society has been transformed by advanced information technologies.
So, but at the same time, as you emphasize in the book, we've grown extraordinarily vulnerable. And you talk about just how completely porous our defenses are. So could you just talk about, you know, the scale of that and why it's a bad thing? You kind of propose strong encryption as an across-the-board, if not solution, policy that should be implemented. But first explain the problem, and then why is that the solution as opposed to other solutions?
Sure. Cybersecurity is indeed in poor shape today, and partly because of, again, a wrong mindset. In the military, there's this belief in firewalls and antiviral software. These are Maginot lines. And as I like to say, we should be, imagine no lines. Figure out that the bad guys will always get in, so make sure they can't benefit from that. That's why strong encryption is so important. Now, in civil society, a similar problem. The business model of cybersecurity is based on those same Maginot lines, and it has left us pretty insecure. I think the trends in civil society are a little bit better. Cloud computing is much more on the rise, and that's important. Now, look, the cloud is simply someone else's computer, but it is somewhere else outside your own system. It's a good place to back up your information so you're less vulnerable to ransomware attacks. But I add a little something else to this in the book, and that is the idea of data mobility. Simply put, data at rest are data at risk. It's going to get got if it's sitting in one place, either on your own system or somewhere in the cloud. And so the idea here is not only to encrypt information strongly, put it in the cloud, but then move it around. And indeed, for very sensitive information, you should break it into parts after encrypting it and then keep those parts moving around. We have the software and the hardware to do this with facility at only modest cost over the way we do business today. And when you factor in the cost of all the intellectual property theft, which, by the way, worldwide is now about $2 trillion a year. And by comparison, ransomware is only about a $20 billion business worldwide. Look, we could take the sting out of IP theft and ransomware if we simply move to this new security paradigm.
So this will be counterintuitive for some people. Why is deploying the cloud and moving data around, it's not obvious why that promotes cybersecurity. I understand what you mean, but you should explain that.
Sure. You used the right word, counterintuitive. Why would I send my sensitive information somewhere else? Isn't it going to be more secure if I have it behind triple-belt firewalls in my own system? The problem is that your own system is in a particular place. And depending on your organization's size, the weakest link among any of your employees is the portal into your system. So if you're one of the Fortune 100 companies trying to protect your intellectual property, well, first of all, if you keep it inside your own system, the bad guys are going to know, hey, I just need to get into that R&D department. And indeed, many years ago, I took a hacker acquaintance of mine who gave me the heads up about the hacking of, I can't mention the company's name, but one of the top companies in the world, that a hacker was roaming free and wild inside their R&D department. And so I brought him to the CIO, the chief information officer of that company. And the CIO said to me, there's absolutely no way anyone could be inside our system. And the hacker who was with me had this little device in his hand, which he was fiddling with while we were talking, and he simply turned it around and showed it to the CIO and showed him how this guy was wandering around inside his own system. So paradoxically, the best way to protect your own information is by putting it out somewhere else in the custody of others cloud services, and then making sure you keep it moving as well. This is particularly important, of course, for our commercial prosperity. Increasingly, it's important for military information security. And I'm proud to say the institution I've been associated with for a very long time, the Naval Postgraduate School, has been one of the pioneers in encouraging the military use of cloud computing services.
So can you talk through one more example? Just take one of the most, you know, the prominent hacks in recent years, SolarWinds or the Microsoft Exchange hack or OPM. How would better encryption have prevented those from happening or weakened or lowered the consequences of those things happening?
Sure. Well, the OPM hack, I was caught up in that. My highly secure personnel file was accessed in that, and all my wife's information too, for which she's never forgiven me. Now, how could we have avoided that? First of all, if that data had remained within the OPM system but had been strongly encrypted, it would have been very, very hard for hackers to make good use of that information. But the second point I would make is that even better on top of encryption would have been to use cloud services to move it offshore so the bad guys don't know. They just have to hack into OPM with its thousands of employees and just guess the password of one of them and get inside the system. So they wouldn't even, you know, how would they even know which web service were being used, et cetera? We would have saved millions of current and former government employees from being hacked and having their most sensitive, my most sensitive classified file was hacked in that case. So we could be doing a lot better if only we embraced these. Again, I have to emphasize, these are simple fixes. And the sad thing is, of course, in the United States, there was a lot of official opposition to the use of strong encryption because law enforcement and intelligence didn't like the idea that people might have information systems that they couldn't peer into.
Right. But what about that? You talk about that in the book, but how are we, this is a huge question and your book is not primarily about this, but I mean, it seems pretty obvious the U.S. government doesn't, you know, half of it does. Officials that work at the NSA, when they leave the government, suddenly they love encryption. But when they're there, you know, they want to be able to surveil and intercept messages and the like, and they worry about encryption. And is your basic view that security is more important than surveillance?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, Jack. You have to do the cost-benefit analysis. We would be so exceptionally better off if security were improved that even if it came at some cost in surveillance, it would be worthwhile. And let me just say, for the record, the bad guys that we're chasing after are already using the strongest encryption out there. To deny it to commercial concerns and individuals is to basically disarm them in the kind of cyber war that I describe as strategic crime. It really keeps those criminals most secure and their victims least secure. So it seems to me that, you know, you've put your finger on it, that there is a great policy discourse that we have to engage on this in a pretty flinty-eyed way.
But of course, commercial readily available encryption has become much more available. But why isn't it more comprehensively available? I mean, what is the barrier? The barrier is not only that the U.S. government in some elements doesn't like it. What is the broader reason why these security measures haven't been implemented, just on a basis where everyone can benefit from it?
I think there are two reasons why encryption, cloud computing, data mobility have really not become the norm. And the first of those reasons is simple market failure, as the economists would put it. The purveyors of these technologies simply have not had demand from consumers for the most secure products. And in the book, of course, I quote from Vint Cerf, who said, you know, at the start of all this, we weren't really thinking about security because it wasn't demanded by the marketplace. And it still isn't. People want products that are cheap, fast, attractive, portable. And so they have moved product development in directions that have never had to emphasize security. In terms of the governmental role, one of the problems we have with government assuming a regulatory role in providing standards is that there are a lot of people on both the left and the right who really don't wish to see government intruding too much into this whole area of information technology. And so while we have government regulation of wide ranges of other types of products in other areas, we've seen a kind of hands-off approach here. So whether the story is sort of at the economic market level or the political regulatory level, we really haven't seen much progress for a long time. And as I note in the book, we're beginning to see a little bit of movement in the right direction, and in part because people are starting to realize in the face of massive intellectual property theft, it just hemorrhages out of our leading companies. And with one incident after another of these terrible ransomware attacks, I think the public consciousness has grown considerably, and I have hope to see a significant change.
So, but isn't the problem hard to overcome? I mean, the basic incentive problem, and I'll just characterize it this way, that the perceived short-term benefits of free or inexpensive new products with high innovation, that American consumers and American firms like to take all those short-term benefits. We export the cybersecurity costs down the road. This has been happening for decades now. Yep. And some version of that logic has been happening for decades. And even as the costs of cyber insecurity grows, that logic still seems to be pervasive. I mean, it's not just the inadequate encryption, it's, you know, liability rules, it's standards for software. All of these measures make products more expensive and make innovation harder. Correct me if you disagree with any of this, but it seems like that there's just a huge collective action problem, and that we just keep exporting cybersecurity costs down the road. And how do you overcome that? I mean, we just don't, even in the face of all these extraordinary events, cyber events of the last 10 years, say, we still haven't made that much progress.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm so frustrated decades after having written Cyber War is coming. It's here, it's terrible, and our habits of mind and institutional interests are keeping us from the solutions that we need to pursue. I think you put your finger on it with the idea of, first of all, short-term perspective, and second, the idea of downstreaming the cost of this, you know, all that IP theft is, you know, the costs are born of that down the road by the consumers, not only here, but around the world. I don't think the government regulatory role need be unduly complex. I really feel there is a role for good governance in this. And I think there should be, can be, and will be. There have been attempts at legislation towards cybersecurity, better cybersecurity standards a number of times. And personally, I think that there is a large middle in the United States, among the electorate, that can certainly be persuadable on this point, given an articulate presentation of the issues. The edges on right and left are going to be hard to bring along. But I think there's a large middle, and it's certainly a discourse worth having.
Yeah. So one word that you don't mention, so you talk about what we should do on defense. You may have mentioned it, but it wasn't mentioned a lot, is the word deterrence. And I take it that that was not an accident.
Not at all. I think deterrence is a good paradigm for nuclear weapons. You know, neither side should be using those. Mutual assured destruction, that still holds. That's pretty good. But whether we're talking about trying to deter insurgents and terrorists, that's just not happening, as we know from the last several decades, not just the last 20 years. And in cyberspace, look, hackers and the cyber core in various countries that are top flight, they just laugh at the whole idea of deterrence, in part because often they operate behind a veil of anonymity. And even when their identities are ultimately, we think we have a pretty good handle on who they might be, it's still never enough to take any kind of firm action. And certainly beyond economic sanctions. And so deterrence is pretty much dead when it comes to cyber war. On the other hand, I do think there's room for a kind of cyber arms control, a behavior-based agreements like those that we have with the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions. And I think we can do that for cyber. But deterrence, that's dead.
So I want to come back to your cyber arms agreements later on. But first, let's turn to what you said earlier, and a central theme in the book. It seems to me that the main audience for this book, if one primary audience for the book, is the Pentagon. And what you said earlier today, what you said at the top of the of our discussion about how DOD really hasn't absorbed and fully learned the lessons of information warfare and these new information technologies, digital technologies, may surprise people. I mean, you talk in the book, you basically say something like the military is taking these new tools and grafted them onto new ways of thinking, but they haven't really moved very much. Could you give us a full sense of what you mean by that?
Well, why did we end up as part of a 200,000 troop presence in Afghanistan for years and years? We were at our very best when just 11 Green Beret A teams were in Afghanistan, less than 200 soldiers working with the tribes, but moving information very, very swiftly as they acquired it from our surveillance systems, as they connected with our close air support, and they drove the Taliban and Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan in a period of just weeks once Donald Rumsfeld set them loose over the objections of senior uniformed leaders. What happened after that? It's as though we forgot all the lessons of that initial phase of operations, which was a true cyber war approach about the not just hurling mass and energy at an enemy, but using information as well and skillfully. What we then did afterward was to plunk down a couple hundred thousand troops between ourselves and our allies and to try to get our information by sending out foot patrols and engaging contact engagements, which usually meant they would be attacked by surprise, or since there were so many of them, lots of them would get blown up by IEDs. We presented our adversaries with lots of targets. And conventional thinking was, well, we have a country of X number of square miles, so we need a couple hundred thousand troops. We'll send them patrolling around, and everything's going to be just fine. And everything wasn't, because our opponents realized that they could operate with a tremendous information advantage of their own. And they learned the lessons that we first taught them in the fall of 2001 and came back. And what we see now, this terrible debacle in Afghanistan, is the whirlwind that we're reaping for not having pursued, developed, and evolved from that first great success in the fall of 2001.
So I'm glad you raised that. Could you say more about that? Because you do talk about, you know, I think you finished the book last fall and, or maybe in December or something like that, but you do talk about the Afghanistan presence. What should we have done, I mean, in Afghanistan using information skillfully? What would the counterfactual look like?
Well, the first strategic insight is that less is more. We should never have ramped up the number of troops and should have kept with the special forces, A teams, and some ranger capabilities for quick reaction. And of course, tremendous support from our orbital and other air surveillance assets, as well as other technologies that we won't talk about on this podcast because they're of a very sensitive nature. But the emphasis should have been on information gathering. And the special forces, it's not just a technical matter. It's the fact that they work closely with the tribal leaders. One of my students was the advisor, for example, to Rashid Dostum, one of the what we would call a warlord, but who played a pivotal role in liberating Afghanistan from the Taliban. And, you know, his 12-man team worked very closely and did just fine. That should have been how we carried the weight of this war. Instead of trying to create a Western-style army, you know, President Biden is often quoted saying, well, we built a 300,000-man army. Why didn't it fight? Well, it was the wrong kind of army. This is a tribal society, and we tried to reroute the currents of culture and history by turning them into an American-style force. And what we ended up doing was taking some of the world's best natural warriors and turning them into the world's worst army, as we saw over the last couple of weeks. So we could have been in there. We could have saved about $1 trillion, been far more effective in the field. And you know, Jack, the lessons were there from Iraq originally. When we used our main forces against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and during the early years of the insurgency there, we made very little progress. But when we packetized our forces into small platoons in little outposts all over Anbar and other provinces, working with friendly locals, we were able to bring the violence down by about 90% in 1 year and keep it down until we walked away. And even the fight against ISIS was won. Actually, a couple of my students, one of whom has tragically died, led a small force working closely with the Kurds that basically drove ISIS to destruction in its home areas in northern Iraq and Syria. So the answers are all out there. But again, we suffer from the habits of mind and institutional interests of an old way of military thinking that we see yet again in this latest disaster in Afghanistan. And which I know the disaster happened before my book was published, but I said it was, you know, it was going sideways.
Yeah. Say more. I mean, introduce the Blitzkrieg idea. Say more about what the Pentagon should be doing and say more about why they aren't doing it. I mean, is it really just habits of mind? I can understand the habits of mind argument 20 years ago, but there are people in mid and senior levels in the Pentagon now who are, if not digital natives, they're close to digital natives. And, you know, we did have lots of senior commanders in the last 20 years who were very adept at using information systems and operations. So say more about what the Pentagon should be doing and why it hasn't done it.
Sure. Let me just say first that organizational culture is sticky. And even the digital natives who are making their way up followed in the train of officers who identified them early in their careers and have brought them along to senior levels. And, you know, they can't help but absorb a lot of those mindsets as they move up and as they move further away from the field, which happens fairly soon at the 12 to 15 year period in a 35 year career. So there's an organizational culture story in play as well.
But, you know, how do you break through that? If that's true, I mean, is that just a permanent problem in the Pentagon?
It certainly is. In a previous book, it led me to suggest that we should close the Pentagon down. You know, it was initially supposed to be turned into a hospital for veterans. I think we've created a centralized system that is in the military that has absolutely crippled innovation. They talk about building a culture of innovation. But again, I say organizational cultures are very, very sticky. So look, I use the term Blitzkrieg. It's a sly reference to a century ago when the Germans figured out that the tank and the plane and the radio combined together in a new organization, the Tank Heavy Armored Division, was going to make a very, very big difference in military operations. And they were willing to do this in part because they'd suffered a defeat in the First World War. The victors in that war said to themselves, well, gee, we did okay. We're going to stick with what we have. And so it was a set of shocking defeats before Britain and Russia and to some extent the United States at Kasserine Pass before they began to adopt these new methods. And so the irony here, of course, in the age of Blitzkrieg, which is less about the bombs and bullets of warfare and more about the bits and bytes, which is why we say Blitzkrieg, the irony of the situation is that it is we Americans who actually have the first demonstration proofs of this, but we're not paying enough attention to our own successes. Instead, I should say an earlier success, Operation Desert Storm, which was a big conventional operation. It didn't need to be, but it was. And a lot of people, the 3 and 4 stars today, had all their formative experience. The lieutenant generals and the full generals and admirals today all had their formative experience in a war over 30 years ago in which our big left hook in the desert was observationally equivalent to Field Marshal Rommel's right hooks in the desert in Africa 50 years earlier. So we're going to have to wait a while, I believe, until those young officers who turned the tide in Iraq, the ones who led the initial engagements with the tribes in 2001 in Afghanistan, they're a decade out from putting on their second and third and fourth stars. And I think that's, you're right, those folks They're not only digital natives, but they had those seminal experiences, and they will keep faith with them. And I think they will finally bring a transformation of the American military.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare 20.
But let me ask you this. You talked about in the book, you gave several examples about how a new military innovation can have changed the distribution of power between nations in wartime.
Yeah.
And more generally. And, you know, I'm increasingly of the view that the internet and digital systems is doing that for the United States. That our adversaries, of course, we don't know what we don't know. There's a lot that goes on in the classified world, but that our extraordinary vulnerabilities and our inability or unwillingness to defend ourselves, and our adversaries seem to be more adept at using these technologies and digital systems to cause us various forms of harm. Are digital systems like the rifle, or is it a new technology that is having distributional effects in the power of nations?
Absolutely. I think the information revolution is going to profoundly reshape power politics. And that's why for Americans, we've got to get with it, since a lot of the things that are diffusing out to the world actually began with us. And you know, that's sort of the case of what happened with Blitzkrieg, right? The diffusion of Blitzkrieg tactics actually led to the Russians eventually overwhelming the Germans. It led to the General Patton's drive in the West. The German run of advantage was pretty short. And so this diffusion problem is one that we face. And I think we're quickly getting behind here. Now, the Russians have suffered tremendous adversity since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And so they've been very open, and they have senior leadership like Gerasimov, and his Gerasimov doctrine is very much attuned to the strategic implications of the new technologies. China hasn't had a similar adversity, but they've been watching closely, and they show every sign of being exceptionally clever about the uses of the technologies, whether for strategic crime, and I think their loose ties with the Asian triads and others are another kind of arms race underway. It's actually an organizational race to build ties with networks, just as the Russians have with hacker networks. Beyond that, I think the Chinese military is showing itself to be tremendously innovative. They're at sea, for example, they're basically building a new kind of sea power without a traditional navy. They have a carrier or two, but they're really emphasizing smart weapons, brilliant mines and hypersonic missiles. And of course, turning little reefs into missile batteries is allowing them to assert control over and against international law in the East and South China Seas. So yeah, I think we're seeing what some call the great power competition reemerging in a way highly to the detriment of the United States.
You have an interesting account in the book why we haven't seen, I guess what I'll call strategic cyber war. Why is that? Why haven't we seen cyber weapons being used at the strategic level?
Yeah, when we talk about strategic cyber war, what we mean are making the power go out over a large part of a country. We've seen some pilot tests of this in the Ivano-Frankivsk Oblast in Ukraine a couple of years back. And that appeared to be a test of how you could shut down power in a certain area, or attacking automated control systems that include coverage of pipelines. Or in Britain, for example, they've got to be worried about those old fens that regulate the water in East Anglia. They have entirely automated systems that are decades old there, and a strategic attack on them could probably flood a big part of Eastern Britain. And sorry, British listeners. And these vulnerabilities go on and on. Now, why don't we see such attacks? Well, because we're not in the middle of a shooting war. And the fact of the matter is, the kinds of cyber weapons needed to engage in these sophisticated strategic attacks are wasting assets. If you use them, first of all, you're letting your enemy know you have the capability to do that, and he'll probably change things around so you won't ever be able to do that again. So these very, very intricate cyber weapons are basically use and lose. So, or fire and forget, whatever metaphor you want to use. So you really want to husband that arsenal until you absolutely, the stakes are high, as in a shooting war. So that's, I think, one of the reasons we don't see much by way of strategic cyber war.
Do you think that our adversaries are getting the best of us with regard to lower level cyber conflict, theft, disruption, information operations, doxing, et cetera? It seems like we are. It seems like they're killing us based on the public record. We don't know, of course, it's hard. You know, I think we get asymmetrical information. There's reporting on what happens to us and less reporting on what we're doing to them. But my sense is that we're getting our clock clean. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. It's the death of a thousand cuts. And again, we're looking at the hemorrhaging of intellectual property, which results in pirated and counterfeit products in the realm of about $2 trillion annually being sold out there. So our prosperity is very much at risk. It seems to me cyber-based political warfare, which can be undertaken by just a handful of operatives using artificial intelligence to amplify, to pretend to be other people in these robot networks, which can be mobilized by hacking into items on the Internet of Things. You can end up with robot networks with hundreds of thousands to in the low millions who are putting out messages for you. And I think not only in the United States, but in open societies in general, we have seen a plague of political warfare emerging from cyberspace. Look, the problem is that in an information age, everything that makes you prosperous and powerful also makes you vulnerable. And for the United States in particular, a point I make in the book, while we have paid a great deal of attention to offensive capabilities, our defenses are the worst, certainly the worst in the developed countries. And I'm not the only one who says this. Richard Clark, who was cyber czar for a couple of presidents, wrote in his book on cyber war, and he actually has a little table there where he reflects on the offensive and defensive capabilities of the leading nations. And the United States comes in absolutely last on defense. And, there was a time we talked about strategic defense initiative in terms of Star Wars against nuclear weapons. And we sort of realized that's never possible, but we need a new strategic defense initiative, and it needs to be aimed at improving our security in cyberspace.
We've discussed this already, but people have been saying that for at least 20 years. You've been saying it for longer than that, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, again, it's part of the institutional story, right? I mean, that's kind of the case. But I think the time is, and one of the reasons I wrote this book now is that I think the time is actually getting ripe to engage in significant change. And it's basically an American grand strategy that not only will improve our cyber defenses, but will make for a world in which there will be less of this kind of disruptive political warfare. That will transform certainly our military and ultimately others in ways that will make the future wars fought actually less bloody, perhaps more disruptive, but make war something less than the terrible scourge it has been, not only in World War II, but since. And so I see reasons for hope, and I think the United States could be truly a leader in this area. We're sending hundreds of millions of vaccines out to the world, even as we try to vaccinate our own country. It's kind of a metaphor for what we should be doing in cyber, too. We should be helping others to defend themselves better, technically and politically, at the same time that we should be trying to improve ourselves. Well, we live in a country where roughly half of it still refuses to be vaccinated. Is it any surprise that there's still so much resistance to moving in more secure directions in cyberspace?
You mentioned artificial intelligence a second ago, and you have interesting thoughts on that in the book. Could you just explain, AI is a huge topic, but how you think that plays out across the range of considerations we're talking about?
Yeah, I think G.I. Joe is going to meet up with A.I. Jane in the future. The aircraft transformed land and naval warfare in the 20th century. A.I. is going to transform operations on land, at sea, in the air, in orbit, and is already transforming cyberspace. Operations move so swiftly there, it's beyond human capacity. So we rely fairly heavily on automated systems. And the challenge here, I think, is to integrate, not to replace humans with AIs, but to integrate, to have units in which the robots serve with humans. We can do this in the air right now. I see squadrons some squadrons will have a few human pilots, a few remote pilots, drones, if you will, and then some fully robotic systems. The same thing is occurring at sea. Frankly, the Chinese are already using AI. A lot of their weapon systems are fully automated. These brilliant minds I talk about, they sit on the bottom of the Taiwan Strait and they're smart enough to recognize what types of ships are coming by and they know what an American carrier looks like. So they're programmed to be able to detach from the bottom and position themselves right under the keel of a ship and detonate and break the back of even the largest super carrier. So there's all kinds of things AI can be doing from the tactical level right up to the highly strategic level. It seems to me that this is waiting to be exploited. A point I also make is that when we think about artificial intelligence in military affairs, it doesn't have to be just something that shoots or detonates. It can also be something that helps us plan. And it seems to me, we already see IBM talking about how AI can be used to help with corporate strategy. Well, AI can also help with military strategy. And again, there's something that the human culture at that highest strategic level is highly resistant. But I'm very heartened by what I see at tactical level in recent years, where human beings, the human soldiers, have bonded very closely with their robots in the field. Sometimes when they get blown up, they get a burial, and sometimes they're given medals to wear.
Are you talking about the robots?
Oh yeah, yeah. Look, people love their cars. Why wouldn't they love their soldier robots?
And what kind of robots exactly are you talking about there? They get burials and medals.
Well, one was one that was a robot that dealt with mines and IEDs. We have other robots that will, for example, go into the building to see what's there. You want to send a human soldier into the most dangerous area, or do you want to send your bot in? And a lot of soldiers' lives have been saved by their bots. And so this is something that's coming along. I will note two quick things about AI and how the military is embracing AI. In December of 2019, we had a very interesting exercise at Fort Benning between a very small defending force and a very large attacking force. And the defenders got all their information, surveillance, and reconnaissance from artificially intelligent observation systems, and which then disseminated the information to the small units that were defending. And they absolutely destroyed the attacking force because they had more information, they had it more quickly, and they used it better. And that's a very, very powerful existence proof. Another sign in air warfare is not too long ago, we had an experiment in dogfighting with a human Top Gun pilot going up against an AI. They were both flying same flight simulators. And in 5 dogfights, the AI won each time, and the human was never able to put a single hit on the AI. And if we really embrace this in terms of air power, we're going to be able to build aircraft that can be designed beyond the tolerance of the human body and reach performance levels that are hitherto unheard of. So it's really a question of which militaries are going to embrace this tie between humans and intelligent machines.
There's all sorts of ethical questions I'd like to ask you about that, but I want to move on to your arms control proposal. So in other areas of international relations, when in security situations, when nations are getting hurt because of weak defenses, and when deterrence doesn't work for various reasons or might not suffice, a third option is cooperation or mutual constraint, where you agree to not do certain things and exchange for your adversary not doing certain things. And yet, I mean, I've talked a bit myself about ways that the United States could improve its security situation through types of cooperation. So why don't you just tell us your general view on that and what works and what doesn't and your specific proposal?
Yeah, look, 25 years ago, I was asked to be part of a team meeting with Russian cyber experts to talk about a range of issues and the possibility of setting some kind of rules of the road. And first, I was deeply impressed that they had a 4-star admiral leading their delegation, their senior international lawyer, and of course a couple of technical experts. And on our end were, you know, some woolly professors, basically. So it gave a sense of how important the Russians felt this gathering was. And we came up with the idea that while you couldn't control the technology, all information technology basically is dual use. You can use it to make money, or you can use it to make war, or just to communicate, etc. So you can't control it the way you can fissile material. But there is another kind of arms control that's based on behavior. The experts call it operational arms control. And we explored that at some length over the course of a week. And I went back to the Pentagon and said, look, it's time to do this. There's a good opportunity to prevent this from getting out of control. And of course, my masters back at the time said, well, we're so far ahead of the Russians, that's the only reason they want an arms control agreement. And so the United States blocked efforts in the UN shortly after that meeting and for years after about any kind of cyber arms control. Now, it is purely behavior-based. You agree not to do certain things. The technology is all there to do terrible things, but you agree not to. And that, it seems to me, is both a strength and a vulnerability, because it's easy to do. You just say, we won't start using these things if you don't, sort of a no first use sort of agreement. A couple of problems with it, aside from the fact that, you know, American leadership was so opposed to it at the beginning. But another problem is it doesn't speak to the non-state actors who are very powerful in the cyber world. My view is it's still worthwhile getting nations to agree, because that would reduce the space. For example, if we had a formal agreement to which both sides adhered, all sides adhered, let's say Russia was a signatory to this, what would the Internet Research Agency be doing now? They wouldn't have the same kind of comfortable haven they have in Russia. So it would be a little more difficult, the permissiveness of cyber mischief by these non-state hacker networks would, you know, you'd have a less permissive world for them. This is not a perfect thing, but it certainly would make things a lot better. And I'm very pleased that President Obama in 2015 pushed for some kind of behavior-based agreement with President Xi of China. And I'm very glad that President Biden raised the issue with Vladimir Putin, you know, when they met recently. So hopefully we'll see some kind of movement in this direction. I think for all its limitations, this is something very much worth doing, and I hope the United Nations is brought in. And certainly AI needs to come under the rubric of some kind of arms control here. It seems to me the UN effort to outlaw lethal autonomous weapon systems is too broad, as I note in the book, but there can be some kind of ways to incorporate and to recognize the sensitivities, legitimate sensitivities about the use of AI in warfare. There's a world of opportunity here, Jack, to explore. Arms control is not dead simply because there's been an information revolution, but arms control will have to be transformed by this era of technological change.
I completely agree. The 2015 agreement with Xi is not a great example for you, because it was basically ignored by the Chinese. And it wasn't a wonderful agreement in the sense that the United States got China to agree to stop doing what the United States already wasn't doing. And that actually leads me to my question. I mean, one hurdle to this approach is that the United States itself would have to give up some capabilities. We'd have to agree not to do certain things with our digital capabilities. Yeah. And we'd have to agree not to do certain things, not just that were convenient to us, like not stealing commercial property to help our companies, the 2015 agreement. Right. We would have to agree, for example, not to use digital tools to disrupt Russian society or something like that.
Right.
And my sense is that no one in the U.S. government is open to this, that no one in the U.S. government, tell me if I'm wrong, is open or thinking hard about giving up Cyber Command or NSA or any kind of DOD capabilities vis-a-vis adversaries. And I think that's just a huge conceptual stumbling block. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think in the main, you're right. It's, you know, I ironically, and I say this from personal experience with folks in the previous administration, I think President Trump was certainly the person most likely to be willing to forge a behavior-based agreement. by which countries would restrain themselves from engaging in political warfare against each other. And it's really interesting. And I think it does go to, you know, profound issues in sovereignty. And that was something that was raised 25 years ago by the Russians, the idea that a cyber arms control agreement should include political warfare. It's fascinating to me how aware they were of that subject all the way back then. But you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons that the American establishment has opposed cyber arms control is because a lot of different institutional interests would be threatened by this. And all I'll say to that is we're talking about a behavior-based agreement here, and you still will have these. You need to have the capabilities of Cyber Command and the National Security Agency, and you want to keep those honed because wars will happen. And the Xi-Obama agreement tried to make that distinction between what you do in peacetime and of course all bets are off once a major war begins. And this of course won't work if all sides don't agree with it. So it seems to me that's the challenge right now, is to suggest ways in which this is in the interest of various countries to sign on. And I think I don't know about China. They feel I think they have a very free hand at the moment. So what levers we might have of another sort, I don't know what can be played there in order to induce interest. But I know the Russians remain very, very interested in this. And maybe that would be a place to start.
Yeah. So, John, my last question is to go back to your idea of a death of a thousand cuts. It seems to me that the cuts are coming more frequently and going deeper and are more consequential, and that that has been happening pretty persistently for a while now. And so just, I mean, where does this end and what does it look like if we continue on this trajectory? How much longer can this go on where we're taking these massive losses of really important data, where this disruption, where ransomware is growing? I mean, what does it look like if we stay on this path, and how long how long do we have until it becomes really unacceptable?
Yeah, if we stay on this path, there's ruin at enormous cost economically, socially, and strategically. And it's another reason I wrote this book. I have a feeling of growing urgency because, as you say, all of the trends that began relatively small have now gotten much broader, much deeper. One of the things that might get us moving in the right direction right now, we're looking at the potential for legislation to, what's the phrase today, build back better, to pay attention to our infrastructure. And I think this could be an opportunity for us with the funds that will be allocated for infrastructure to take a good hard look. At least 80% of our country's infrastructure was built before the internet and the web, the World Wide Web, yet are connected to it. And this is a profound engineering problem. So when we build back better, one of the things we want to do is make sure that these older systems are upgraded. Colonial Pipeline had software that was several decades old and was a walk in the park for hackers to get at. So we really need to do a lot of software re-engineering of older infrastructure. And if we begin there, perhaps we can build on it. I think, you know, we've got to run the table one ball at a time. There's no way to hit the cue ball here and make all the balls go in all the pockets simultaneously. You know, we're not Minnesota Fats, but I think we can line things up. And if we hit infrastructure first, if we look at the expansion, build on the current trend toward the expansion of cloud computing, if we get right with encryption as a society, and that's going to take an administrative as well as a public discourse, I think there are steps we can take along the lines I've outlined in the book. And as far as the military is concerned, I do think you're right that there are digital natives who within a decade or so are going to be putting on 3 and 4 stars and open up the possibility of significant change. The question is, do we have a decade? My sense is we probably don't. Action this day should be our mantra.
John, thanks very much. That was great.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hamza Shatou was the podcast audio engineer. This podcast, as always, is edited by Jen Pacha Howell. Thank you to Sophia Yan for providing the music. To help this podcast, please leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.